Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Ryan Dobson, along with our host, psychologist and best-selling author, Dr. James Dobson. And even in studio today is our physician in residence, Dr. Meg Meeker.
I know. It's so great to be face-to-face.
Normally, you're in Michigan. We're on headphones trying to see through Skype.
You just landed, didn't you?
I did. Just about an hour and 20 minutes ago, and I'm ready to go.
And you're going to be here most of
I'm going to be here all week. It's going to be wonderful. We've got a great lineup of shows to do, and so I'm ready to work.
Yeah, and today we're going to kick it off with a good
one. Yes, we are.
Yeah, we are at that. People wonder how you could do the program from Michigan like you do. Explain how that works.
Well, Family Talk has graciously supplied me with the wonderful technology to have a studio actually in my study at home. So we, all through the internet, we broadcast so that when I'm on Skype looking at you and using the radio equipment, we sound like we're in the same room together. And often it feels like we're in the same room. There's nothing that replaces face-to-face, though.
Yeah.
Particularly with guests.
I like to be able to see your face and see the twinkle in your eye and
thank you.
Know you want to talk. Yeah. So, well, it's good to have you here. I agree
thank
with
you.
Ryan. And Ryan, we owe you a note of congratulations today because you had an article in the Wall Street Journal just a few weeks ago, and I'm telling you, that's a big deal.
It has been a huge deal. Honestly, I really do need to give a lot of credit to our good friends at Level Fairchild. Nancy and Julie helped me write that, and they placed it, and we were flying home. I found a copy in the airport, and I mean, I was like a little kid. I was, I was so giddy. I was embarrassed. I felt like just tapping people around me like, I wrote this. I'm in the paper today. It was such a big deal for me.
That is quite an accomplishment. We've got to move on, but give the title of the editorial.
Well, it's really the theme is legacy. It's on what are you going to leave the next generation? What are you going to leave your kids? And I juxtaposed you and your great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, with Kim Kardashian. Or Kim Kardashian West. She's now married to Kanye. She's got a brand new book coming out. 352 pages.
Of selfies.
Of photos of herself. And the book is called Selfish.
Yeah.
Of all things. And I thought, this is what I say to you. Because people go, oh, but can you imagine how much that publisher paid her for that? Well, I can. I'm sure it was.
A lot.
A ton of money. But she doesn't need it. If you don't need the money, putting that out you don't need to do it. She doesn't need the money, and it's setting a terrible, terrible example. My wife's not buying that book. Dr. Meeker, you're not buying Selfish.
No.
But there's a ton of teenage girls that look up at Kim Kardashian
and
that
will
and
it.
Think this is how you've made it. And it's what I tell people is your goal in life isn't to have your name on buildings. That's never been your goal. But it is to pass on Jesus Christ to the next generations. It is to help parents be good parents and husbands and wives to be good spouses. That's what your legacy is.
That's been my objective for more than 40 years now. Mm-hmm. Well, tell us the title of the op-ed.
The title is called Get Over Your Selfie.
Oh, I love it.
So, it's really very clever.
Yeah, that's great.
And while it's difficult, this is the only thing that was a bummer is the Wall Street Journal online edition. You have to be a subscriber to read the whole article. I didn't know that at first. So I have put the entire article on my website, which is jamesryandobson.com. You can read the whole thing there. If you go to Wall Street Journal, you'll get like two sentences. You get nothing of the article. But if you go to my website, you can read the whole thing.
Well, I hope our listeners will do that.
Me too.
Okay.
Let's get to our guest. We have
a guest here that I'm anxious to get to talk to, and I'm so pleased that he's here. His name is Roland Warren, and he's the author of a book that we all really like. It's titled Bad Dads of the Bible. Very creative and very helpful content in that book. And it's fascinating. And I am excited to talk to him today. He's currently the president and CEO of CareNet. CareNet has over 1,000 affiliates or centers, which make it one of the largest networks of pregnancy care centers with affiliates in the United States and Canada. CareNet's Christ-centered mission is to promote the culture of life within the society in order to serve women and men facing unplanned pregnancies. In addition, Roland is a much sought-after keynote speaker on topics ranging from fatherhood, which we're going to talk about today, to marriage and the family. And he's been all over the national media. He's been on the Oprah Winfrey Show and the Today Show and Fox and Friends and CNN and C-SPAN and Fox News Channel, as well as being interviewed by many major radio and newspaper outlets. So it is a real honor, Roland, to have you here with us today.
Well, thank you, Dr. Dobson. Glad to be with you.
And what a clever and interesting book you have now written, Bad Dads of the Bible. How'd you come up with that?
Yeah, it's Bad Dads of the Bible, Eight Mistakes Every Good Dad Can Avoid, to get the subtitle in there as well. And, you know, it's interesting because I actually started writing the book in some ways because I was perplexed and to some degree, I guess, frustrated. Because when I started doing work with National Fatherhood Initiative, over a decade ago, you know, one of the things I thought would be easy to do was to get the church really engaged on the fatherhood issue and get the church excited and moving forward, especially given all the data out there in terms of the impact of father absence on kids and certainly the biblical kind of construct that talks about fatherhood and motherhood and our Heavenly Father. And what I found was that you know, frankly, the church really wasn't as engaged on this issue as I thought.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, if you think about it, you know, Jesus started with men's ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at most churches, unfortunately, and you look at the ministry profile in the church, probably the weakest ministry profile in most churches is men's ministry. And if you're not going to have a strong men's ministry, then you're probably not going to have the kind of focus on fatherhood that you should have. And so anyway, I got sort of perplexed by that, and I had this epiphany that God gave me that there was this notion that there was a view that if a guy was going to be a good Christian, he would automatically be a good dad.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That was the point of view. And, you know, I'd meet with pastors and I'd talk about it and they'd tell me their fatherhood stories and they'd talk to me about how important fatherhood was. But when I asked them specifically, what are you doing in your church specifically to help men be the kind of fathers that God really has designed them to be and that their children and the mothers of their children need them to be, what I found was that typically there wasn't much that was done.
But what's amazing is that the bad dads of the Bible tended to be the great patriarchs of the Bible.
Right.
Absolutely.
These were men that are lauded throughout Scripture. You know, we talk about David, for example, and start with him. But he was a man after God's own heart. He was a terrible dad.
We've talked about that before.
Yeah.
You know, that just because you're a believer does not give you a free ride. It doesn't mean your kids are going to be good.
Can I back up for a second?
Yeah, sure.
I want to ask Roland, why are churches not focusing on fathers?
Well, I think in a lot of ways, you know, when you ask the question why churches are not focusing on fathers, what I found was one thing. There was this presumption that if we just get a guy saved, he'll automatically be a good father.
Right.
I think that's part of it. But I think also that the other part of it is that the culture has had an enormous impact on the church, I think, in a lot of ways. I mean, if you look at the way that fathers are portrayed in the broader culture, they're dumb, dangerous, or disaffected.
They're fools.
Right.
They make them fools.
Absolutely. And so I think the church at some level, given that we're kind of part of the culture, we're in the culture, I think there's been some of that narrative. And I think the third thing is that, you know, frankly, men are tough to deal with. You know, you put something together for guys, we don't always show up the same way that women do. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, you know, you go after the low-hanging fruit. And think, well, if we get the moms engaged and we work on children, that we're going to have the kind of church that we need to have. But the reality is that, you know, God has designed a family in a certain way, has designed a role for men.
Right.
And you're not going to have a healthy church, certainly not one consistent with God's design, that doesn't include engaging and involving fathers. And I think the last thing I would say is that there's been a lack of creativity in terms of how to engage men within the church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think about the stories, as I said, Jesus started with men's ministry, and you look at how he called Peter. You know, he called him and he missioned him, and he called him in a context that he understood.
Right.
So he called him and said, I'm going to make you a fisher of men. And you could Zacchaeus, he called him down from a tree. He didn't ask him to be a fisher of men. He said, let's do a power lunch, right?
Right.
Because he was an influential guy.
Right.
What would make difference for him? So you've got to call men and you have to mission men in a context that they understand, and that takes a lot more creativity. I think most of the stories that you look at in Scripture where women are in Scripture, he didn't have to call any of them. They just came, even if they had to come on their hands and knees just to touch the hem of his garment. Right. So it's a different kind of thing, and I think it's harder work, and as a result, sometimes I think the church doesn't work as hard to do it.
Roland, I would like to start with your background. Mm-hmm. You didn't have a father in the home.
Right.
How did this become a passion for you?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I tell people all the time that pain then is part of the happiness now. You know, I had grown up without my dad and kind of saw the impact that had on my life.
Were your parents divorced, or did your dad was he not there from the beginning?
Well, they were married in the beginning. My mom and father, they had a, you know, teen pregnancy, and so they got married around that time, and were married for a number of years, and my brother was born during that time, and then I was born during that time, and then over time, I'm not sure of all the things that happened there, but he just started to be not there, and so I grew up without him around on an everyday basis.
So how old were you when you realized that he wasn't there? Were you?
I'd say probably 5, 6.
Okay.
I mean, I don't have a lot of memories. I don't have a lot of memories of my father being in the home even while my parents were married.
Mm-hmm. Was that hard for you?
You know, it's interesting. As I think about it now as an adult, it was very hard because I can see how it impacted me. It impacted my relationships and certainly impacted my brother in a big, big way. And I mentioned to you before we started the show that my older brother died when he was 10 and I was—
He drowned.
Yeah, he drowned when we were on vacation. When he was 10 and I was 8. And, you know, we were already starting to act out. You know, when I was in second and third grade, you know, we'd skip school and spend time running around town and make like we'd gone to school. You know, so we were a handful then. And as I look back on it as an adult, I can really see
the absence of male leadership.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and the impact and how difficult that was for my mom.
Does it break your heart, you being an African-American, what's happening to fatherhood in the African-American community?
Absolutely.
And you know, the 70% of black babies are born out of wedlock. Mm-hmm. I've seen some figures as high as 75. That's a tragedy of enormous proportions, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, we've sown the wind and reaped a whirlwind of negative consequences. And when you look at some of the most intractable social ills that are affecting our nation, they are very much tied back to father absence. And unfortunately, you see so many of those in the African-American community. I've lived it. I've seen it, certainly in my life as well.
Explain it to us. Why is that figure so high?
Well, you know, it really has, in a lot of ways, has to do with the breakdown of marriage. You know, a lot of times people don't want to talk about that. And when I was with National Fatherhood Initiative, people said, well, let's just try to connect fathers to kids. And the reality is the best societal glue to connect fathers to kids heart to heart is marriage. And so when you see an erosion of marriage in the African-American community, you're going to see an erosion of involved, responsible, and committed fatherhood as well.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you link it back to the Great Society and the decisions that the government made that required men to be absent in order for mothers to be able to get government support?
Yeah, I think that had an enormous impact. I mean, if you look at the data, you see sort of a drop-off in the late 60s when those programs went in place. And essentially, you know, frankly, women in the community, they could either, quote, marry the government or marry the guy who was the father of their kids. Mm. And too often there was a disconnection there. And I think also, candidly, people stop talking about it as an important institution in the community.
And marriage or fatherhood?
Marriage specifically. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you know, you had the fatherhood piece that was also damaged in the process as well.
Mm-hmm. My sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, and this is probably something that I can add because as a female here, but my sense is around the 70s with the rise of feminism, and you had the sexual revolution, and you had, you know, free sex, and women turned on men. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of colleagues. I was at an all-women's college in the 1970s, and I remember some of my my colleagues and students really saying, whatever men have, we want, and whatever they do, we want to do better. And what I've seen through the 70s and the 80s is, and not just the government coming in and providing for children what dads should have provided for and for the marriage, but also women pushing men out. Mm-hmm. And I think there's tremendous animosity between men and women today. And I don't know if you gentlemen see it, but the jokes about men and fathers on the internet that are supposed to be funny
are commercials, everywhere, and TV shows.
Everywhere. And but I think even in a home, and I've even noticed this with myself, my husband and I have been married for 33 years. We're partners in our medical practice and we raised four kids. But there are times that I will talk to him as though I know more about parenting than he does. It's my tone of voice. And I have to stop myself, and I try to be aware of it. But I really do think there's a responsibility that women in our culture have, moms in our culture, that we need to shore up our attitudes and behavior because we push men out.
Yeah.
And I don't think
this is okay. I
believe
you're absolutely right on that. I sure do.
Dad, I want to ask where it came from, though, because I don't have any, like, I have no problem with women's sports. My wife was a college volleyball player. She coached a high school team. She's still incredibly athletic. I have no problem with that. I just don't know where the, in order for us to be good, you have to be bad mentality came from. You know, there used to be a Home Depot commercial. I didn't go there for years because of it. It was a salesman helping a woman, and he was talking to her about something, and it had lasers, which meant I wanted to buy it. And at the it was a helpful product. And at the end, she goes, oh, so you mean I don't need him? And the camera pans over to the boyfriend or husband, and he's got a plunger stuck to his face.
Yeah.
And it was the brunt of the joke. You didn't need that. That woman's a strong, capable, put together, building something on her own woman. You don't need to make fun of the man for that commercial.
I think what we've said around the table by the three of you, and I certainly agree with it, is that it came out of the feminist movement when there was a war, declared between men and women.
Yeah.
There was hatred. I mean to tell you, there was competition at every level. And men, under those circumstances, tend to take a step back. They don't get in and compete or fight for their position or not only not authority, but not even respect. And men just sort of said, okay, you want it, you can have it. And they went and did something else. And especially for some reason, it happened within the black community more than it did in the Caucasian and other racial entities. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, these movements that happen in certain communities, even though it's the same movement, it can have a different impact. And one of the ways I try to help people understand, I say, well, you know, if you're an 85-year-old guy and you present with pneumonia, they're probably going to put you right in the hospital in the emergency room. If you're a 25-year-old guy and you present with pneumonia, they might just say, well, listen, we're going to do some things and send you home.
Mm-hmm.
So and what's the difference there? Well, if you're an 85-year-old guy, your system is more fragile than if you are if you're a 25-year-old guy.
I think that's changing with Obamacare.
Right.
But imagine an 85-year-old man
illustration.
Coming in and saying,
you have a good point there. But, but I mean, in terms of the point I'm trying to make here is that the black community – certainly at that time, in terms of social, economic, political power, having these same worldviews in a community that is more fragile can have a much more devastating impact. And I think that in a lot of ways, the delinking of marriage and fatherhood and motherhood, even though that's happened in the broader culture, because of all the other stressors in the African-American community, it's had a much, much, much broader impact.
All right. Let's talk specifically about your book and the Bad Dads. And you chose to start with David, although it probably should have started chronologically with Abraham. Why David?
Well, you know, David, I started with David. There's no science to it. It was the first chapter that I wrote because it was the one that connected the most to my personal story and the issue that that I found most difficult. And it's these eight mistakes. And the mistake that we talked about there is he was paralyzed by his past.
Mm.
And, you know, what I talked about in that particular chapter is how David handled the fact that his son Amnon raped Tamar and then Absalom, you know, sort of what happened there.
By the way, that's a horrible story.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, he just flat out raped his, I guess, half-sister.
Yep.
And David didn't do anything about it.
Absolutely. Didn't do anything.
He was not a disciplinarian. He was kind of wishy-washy, wasn't he?
He was. And I started to think, well, why didn't he do something? And what hit me was, this notion that he was paralyzed by his own past. Because if you think about what Amnon did, it's frankly the same thing that he did with Bathsheba.
Right.
And when you add some humanity to this, I mean, they're in a palace. Everybody in the family knows. Everyone knows the story. And one of the things that the evil one will do is he'll get in your ear when you're about to do something that you know you need to do and say, who are you to do that thing?
Yeah. You're not so perfect yourself.
Exactly. And so I had that same sort of scenario with my the story I use in that particular chapter is talking about the fact that, you know, I got my girlfriend pregnant when I was in college, and you know, we ended up getting married, been married for 30-something years. But I then had to talk to my son, my oldest son, about saving sex for marriage. And I was paralyzed. I really was, because I started thinking to myself, how can I tell him to do something that I failed in? And, you know, I talked to so many fathers over the years who've told me different things, like, you know, I used drugs when I was in college, but I'm not going to tell my kids not to do it because I'm a hypocrite, or that kind of thing. And it just struck me that that is a huge, huge mistake that so many fathers make, that they allow their past to paralyze them, and it puts their children in at risk because they won't speak out in the case where they really should.
The beautiful thing about David's story is that God forgave him.
Yes.
Of the horrible sin. I mean, he killed a man, or essentially got him killed. He put him on the front lines of the battle, took his wife, had sex with her. I mean, who knows how many concubines he had. He didn't really need to do that.
Yep.
There's no justification for anyone, but especially for a man like David.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he was flawed. What's really interesting to me, Roland, from your book and elsewhere, is that I think the Lord is showing that there is none that is without sin.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one.
Yes.
Even the great men of the Bible.
Yes.
With the exception of Christ himself. I mean, look at Paul. He was standing there holding the coats when Stephen was stoned to death. That all of us are flawed.
Yes.
Peter, you know, denied Christ three times right at the critical moment of the before the crucifixion. So the Bible is showing that none of us can do it on our own.
Absolutely. No, that's, you know, and the thing that was encouraging for me, you know, as I was writing the book and particularly starting with David, is that, you know, mistakes are what we do, but they're not who we are.
Right.
You know, and if you allow yourself to get into a place where you actually look at yourself as a mistake, it leads you down a path that can be a very, very devastating one. So
my counselors talk about that.
Yeah.
Behavior is what you do, not who you are.
Yes.
And we get stuck with, oh, this is who I am. I am a failure.
Mm-hmm.
I am a bad person.
Yes.
When I did a bad thing, but I can move on from that. And that's where Christ comes in.
Absolutely.
Ryan and Meg, we're out of time
here. Oh, my goodness.
But I can't believe how fast that went. One of the things I've appreciated about you is you are giving priority to those two kids. You really are. You're not perfect, man, but you
not.
But you care about fathering
those
children.
I do.
And give them the best that you have.
I had a good role model.
Yes, you did.
I did.
Yeah.
It's there's no mistake about that. There really is. I see that in all different areas.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last few years, I keep being asked what the greatest gift my parents gave me. And I think it's a loving, supporting marriage.
Mm.
You know, this year, 54 years, I'll never, ever understand how deep that goes.
Mm-hmm.
But I appreciate it. And I'm trying to do it for my kids.
The truth of the matter is Shirley and I are closer and more bonded to each other right now than we were when we started, you know, or even halfway through. The Lord has just blessed us. And we had our devotions the other day and just thanked the Lord for the love that he gave us. Mm-hmm. Meg, you have that
same thing. We just celebrated 33 years, you know, and Walt and I work in an office together. He's a physician as well. We started our practice together and people say, how do you do that? But I will tell you, I cannot imagine life without that man. And you come to a place you're just so cemented together, and God blesses your faithfulness to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what people who are struggling, who've been married 5, 10, 20 years, hang on, because God makes it so rich and so deep that you just, one breathes in and the other breathes out.
It's really that way.
Yeah.
Well, Ron, we are barely started in your book. The title of it is Bad Dads of the Bible. Great concept and a very good book. And we only began with David here. Mm-hmm. We didn't get any farther than that. But let's do it again
next time.
And we will pick up and try to stay on target a little better.
That's all right. This is good stuff. I'm learning a lot.
I met you about 6 months ago when you were having a board meeting at the CareNet. Mm-hmm. And I came in and greeted everyone. And you and I were introduced. And then you handed me a copy of this book. And I said, let's see what we can do.
Yes.
Okay.
Much.
Well, thank you all for the program today. And we will talk to you tomorrow.
Okay.
Thank you.
Blessings to you.
And if you'd like more information about Roland or the ministry of CareNet or the book Bad Dads of the Bible, contact us at Family Talk on our website, drjamesdobson.org, or calling us 877-732-6825. God bless. Thanks for joining us today. And don't forget to return tomorrow for this conclusion.
Family Talk is not affiliated with Focus on the Family.